This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want to honor them for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories for posterity. We don't want to forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way in these conversations, we learn a lot about the men and women who have been willing to put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom. And we're going to do that today with a 92-year-old Marine Corps veteran. It's important to note that this weekend marks the anniversary again of December 7th, 1941, the attack on Pearl Harbor. And our guest today was in the vicinity that day. We're going to get that story, but we'll start earlier on than that. 92-year-old Elmer Wright, you're originally from Texas. What was it like growing up a boy in Texas?
Well, we had pretty hard times. We had a dairy there, about 92 head of cattle, and we had a drought come 4 years. And we got rid of the cows and came to California. He said, money growed on trees out here. Then I worked for the Dennis Creamery a while. I got out of school at 10th grade, and I run that truck on the west side picking up milk.
I guess if you grew up on a dairy, you'd been milking cows since you were a little guy, huh?
I think about 7 years old we started milking cows. We were old enough to go to school, was old enough to milk a cow. Mm-hmm. That was by hand. He didn't have milking machines then.
How do you feel about that? All the dairies now, it seems like milking a cow by hand is a lost art.
I don't know. I used to milk a cow as fast as that machine could.
So when you came out to California, you were out on the west side in San Joaquin, and you were milking cows out there too?
Holmes Ranch was out there, and we'd taken care of his dairy. My daddy had a contract, and we'd go there and milk his cows every morning. He had a milking machine. I'd milk one cow while the machine's on the other, and then I'd beat the machine in, take it off, and put it on another cow. There's three of us milking.
You said you quit school after the 10th grade. Where did that decision come from? Why did you decide to do that?
Well, things were pretty hard then. See, 1936, that was the grapes of the wrath come. It's gravy without any bread. I don't know, I guess on account of the family, I had to quit school.
Because the family needed you to work to try to supply some income?
Yeah, but it wasn't late there. After that, I joined the Marine Corps, and I volunteered and went in.
And this is before America was in the war. What about the Marine Corps excited you? What drew you to that branch of service?
Well, I went down to the Canadian Air Force. He was one volunteers. And I went in there, and I was going to get it in Canadian Air Force. And Marine recruiting officer right there next door. And the sergeant says, hey, you know, you're not going to get any benefits. And he talked me in, and I signed up. Next day, he went to take me out to lunch and put me on the train, and it ended up in Los Angeles. We stayed there about a week before we come down to San Diego. And Mickey Rooney, he was trying to get in the Marine Corps. They wouldn't let him in on County Hike.
You were there the same time as Mickey Rooney?
Yeah, but Mickey Rooney couldn't get in the Marine Corps. He was too short. And then they used to be pretty strict on your height. I think they had to be 5'10", 142 pounds.
Well, I want to backtrack here. You said you were trying to get into the Canadian Air Force, and I've talked to people that were trying to do that. Usually they were a little closer to the border than you were way out here in California. Why did you want to get in the war so bad that you would go to another country and fight for them?
I don't know. A lot of guys volunteering going in the service. I thought I was getting up while I could go in, and I guess that's the reason.
All right. So the Marine Corps recruiter talks you into joining up with them. How long did it take before you said, well, maybe I didn't make the right decision here? I'm sure there were some hard times there as they broke you in.
You're telling me? Yeah, a lot of guys got kicked out of the Marine Corps. If they didn't qualify as a marksman, they'd send them back home. And then I went to sea school. That's how come we be aboard ship. And we made that movie, The Shores of Tripoli. I was in on that.
You were part of the making of the movie?
Yeah. And I had my picture taken for Maureen O'Hara and Nancy Kelly. Got married, my wife cut it up.
She didn't want to look at those ladies all day long, huh?
Yeah, it was a great honor, you know.
So you're part of this this movie, just you and a bunch of other Marines were extras in the film?
We had a bunch of guys from Hollywood down too, and like Maxine Rosenblum and all those. They had about six or eight of them, then the rest of us are.
Yeah, you know, I looked it up, and you can actually watch that entire film online, shot in 1941, released in 1942, To the Shores of Tripoli was the title. Maybe a little rosier picture than what Elmer Wright actually experienced in the Marine Corps. I think it's hilarious that your wife destroyed that photo of you at those Hollywood starlets. And I know he wasn't the headliner, but you mentioned there Slapsy Maxie Rosenbloom. And I'm interested in your memories of him because I've called about 200 basketball games with his nephew, Randy Rosenbloom, who idolized his uncle and is actually working on a special project to honor him. So what do you remember about Slapsy Maxie Rosenbloom?
Well, he was kind of a boxer or something in his past. And I know he come to the ring barracks, knocked their rifles over, and he was barred. He wasn't allowed to come in there anymore. No, he is pretty good.
How did he treat you guys?
Oh, good. We got along with him fine. Yeah, I thought maybe he was going to get in the Marine Corps, but I don't guess he did.
And he was a bit of a comedian, wasn't he?
Yeah. And we had Randall Scott. He was there. I think he played as a master sergeant or something. And that rest period, we'd come in, we'd get in their bus, and we'd talk with him. He's a man you'd feel you know all your life. I really had a lot of respect for him in that.
And this is all before you got shipped out?
Yeah.
So you get done with that, and then they're shipping you out on an oil tanker and sending you to Hawaii. You must have been excited. You're going to go see these tropical islands.
Yeah. I think the Fiji Islands one I enjoyed the most there. The sailors got trading their underwear to these women. They had their names on them. MPs would check the names and turn them back in the ship to find out where they were coming from, and they put a stop to that. All those girls, I don't know, the Navy, I don't know if they're having affairs with them or not, but they'd trade them their underwear.
Give us a feel for this ship, because I'm sure it was mostly Navy, but you're one of the few Marines on board. What were your duties?
Well, we manned almost all the machine guns. Then we manned two broadsides, and sometimes we manned the anti-aircraft batteries. And we were security on there, too.
So your job was, if something happened, if you guys were to come under attack, you were to man a machine gun.
Yeah, I think we were. I know our skipper one time praised us for some work done and the Marine detachment, and kind of hurt a lot of the sailors' feelings about it.
Well, you must have had a pretty good eye. You must have had been a pretty good shot.
Well, mostly machine guns. I know we knocked down a plane, about three of them there one day, but you didn't know which guy hit it. There's one guy say, oh, he's bragging about he's the one that knocked it down. But then we hit one that was burning on fire, and it was coming right towards the ship. And it hit the water just about 12 feet from the ship and flowed right along the side and sunk. Yeah, he's trying to make it to that smokestack, but he didn't quite make it.
You're talking about the battleship USS Colorado now. That's the one you were wounded on in July of 1944, and a ship that would get hit by kamikazes after you left it. But I want to make sure we don't miss your story of December 7th, 1941. I ask every veteran about that day, but not every veteran was in the vicinity of Oahu that day. And you were. You were part of a Marine contingent on an oil tanker just outside of Pearl Harbor. Let's start that Sunday morning when you woke up. What do you remember about that Sunday morning, December 7th?
Late about, missed about 20 minutes after the explosion there in Pearl Harbor. We had general quarters. We didn't have no ammunition or nothing, but we stood out with the rifles and all that, but I don't know what we could have done. Didn't have any ammunition for them.
And where were you guys?
Right outside the harbor. Now, they never bombed nothing outside the harbor. They never bombed the sub base either. They hit the U.S. Maryland. They hit it in number one turret and busted it. That's the ship I was supposed to went on, but so we waited there in the, I think the Colorado was in Brampton, Washington then. When it come there, we went aboard there.
So you're on this oil tanker outside of Pearl Harbor, and the first thing that tells you something that's going on is they sound general quarters and say, we're under attack, we're at war, or what?
Yeah. Well, everybody was kind of decided. Now, the two Japanese planes come. It was coming back from Pearl Harbor after they jumped the bomb. They flew right over us, but someone said, yeah, they're Japanese. Then the second or third day, they lowered a boat, rowboats, and we didn't have motors. There's nine of us, and we made a landing down there right outside Pearl Harbor in the cane field there, and I was sick. And I wanted to lay down and let them go, and they said, no, we don't leave no Marines behind. And we went on that way. We got made into Marine barracks before dark, but boy, I was sick that day. It didn't matter to me what happened. I didn't think I was going to make it. But about 3 days later, I got feeling better, and he made a mess cook out of me. And that about 7 or 8 days, and we started putting out balloons up in the air with cables on them. In case planes come in, they'd hit them cables. Then second day after we got them balloons up in the air, one of our own planes hit it, right there in the Harbor.
Some have said that if they actually had barrage balloons in place before December 7th, that it would have prevented the air attack or at least limited it. I've got to ask you about that scene there, though, on December 7th. Do you remember looking out and seeing the aftermath of that attack, seeing the smoke from the Arizona?
When night come around, you could see it real good, too. Yeah, we must have been a mile out from the entrance of the harbor.
So you said when night fell, you could see it. So you could still see fire burning or what?
Yeah, flashes, a lot of smoke.
Most of us, you know, we've seen the footage, we've seen the pictures, but we weren't there. We didn't smell it. We didn't see it with our own eyes. What was it like in real life to look out and see that? What did you see, and what did it feel like?
It's a hard thing to tell how a guy felt.
Did it hurt to know that so many Americans had died there?
Yeah. I was strictly Marines. We were chip, we were a company of Marines there, but we were just like a more loved family. We knew the strength of each man and what he could do and everything. And we hate to see one of our own men killed, but it didn't bother me too much. Sailors was killed, but should have, but I had a lot of friends sailors.
And I don't want to keep you here too long, but I want people to understand, because you hadn't seen any action yet. I mean, you've been part of this movie, and but this is real. War is here, and people are dying. Did that add some fuel to your fire? Did that motivate you to go out there and fight the Japanese?
Not really. We were mostly concentrated on our job, what we had to do. I know one time, well, it was off Saipan, there's eight planes coming 80 miles away. The time we got up on the gun, the planes was already there. And I think we knocked down three or four of them. And one of them, dropped a torpedo, hit one of the ships. We went to Guam, and after that, in Simpson demolition outfits, it was in civilian clothes, about 3 o'clock in the morning. And they were in rowboats. I never heard what happened to them. That's before they ever made a landing on Guam.
I think I interviewed some of those guys. They went in on an underwater demolition team on rafts in the middle of the night. Yeah.
I was on watch that night. They were all ready to get down those boats, and we went off and left them there. They headed for the beach. They must have all got killed or something happened to them.
Well, I know there was a gentleman here in Sanger who was one of those frogmen on Guam, and he made it out alive and got a Silver Star. So, but your guys, you're now on a battleship, the USS Colorado. Your job is to bombard these islands to create cover to get troops ashore, right?
That's right.
And the first island was Tarawa in November of 1943. This was a bloody, bloody scene. Nearly 1,700 Americans died there, the majority of them Marines. And with all the pre-invasion shelling you guys did, you probably didn't expect such a fierce fight.
Tarawa, we knocked down the palm trees are really beautiful, and we come in pretty close. We didn't fire till it got close, and then the Japanese fired on us. The water splashed up like the ship. It's kind of short. But then all the ships started bombarding. I mean, they cleaned every tree and everything on that island. I don't know how they survived that, but they had channels, concrete channels, crisscross. When the bombers come down, they'd go around the corner when they see one coming. But we lost over 1,000 Marines that morning.
Yeah, they had a hard time getting to the beach. They got hung up on coral reefs and got picked off there, right?
Yeah, but I couldn't stand why they done that on the end of the island. Now it's flat down there. But a tide was out and reefs sticking up all out in the water and barbed wire entanglement. Barge got tangled in that. They finally put a load of dynamite on a barge and knocked that reef down. And some of the guys I heard run plumb across that island.
So when you saw that, when you're there offshore, you're shelling this island, and you know that these Marines are dying, and you realize that, was that harder for you to take? Was that more real to you than what you had seen at Pearl Harbor a couple years earlier?
I know one time it kind of shook me up. They said, this is Tarawa. That's the first island we hit. But they said that the task force ships left trucking on their way there. That kind of had me kind of stirred up. I said, man, we ain't going to have a chance here. But they never did show. And on the day, the six of us went over their security when they signed the surrender. And then some Japanese officers kept talking to these natives in their tongue. And old Holland Smith told the platoon leader to bring him down. He shot him, killed him right there doing the ceremony. Then they pulled a big old truckload of flatbed truck CBs, about 100 dead Japanese on it, pulled it up and sit there. That was on Tarawa. And I got hit on the arm. I got a scar right here. Knocked my rifle out of my hand.
You had gone ashore with a few other Marines?
Security.
Security for who?
For signing the surrender there.
Gotcha. So when General Holland Smith accepted the Japanese surrender of Tarawa, I don't want folks to think we're talking about the ultimate surrender on the USS Missouri or anything. This is the end of that brief but bloody battle at Tarawa in November of 1943, more than 70 years ago now. And while this is happening, you're part of a small Marine detachment providing security for the general for this surrender. And you got hit by a bullet while you were ashore for that?
Yeah, while I was ashore, yeah. It wasn't too bad, but left a big scar there.
Well, I know you have other scars that almost claimed your life, and you've got plenty of memories, too. We're going to explore some of those when we return with 92-year-old Purple Heart recipient Elmer Wright of Clovis, California. And speaking of Clovis, a brief aside here. You hear me talk about hometown heroes and how no matter how big or how small your hometown is, you have the opportunity to honor your heroes there, and I've seen many shining examples of that here in California and across the country as I travel. But it's hard to find any hometown that honors its veterans better than Clovis does. The Clovis Veterans Memorial District exists for that very purpose, and Clovis is also one spot where a very special tribute will take place next Saturday, December 14th, not just in Clovis, but if you're listening today in Manteca or Sacramento, Sonoma, maybe you're within reach of Santa Nella and the San Joaquin Valley National Cemetery there, the Bakersfield National Cemetery near Arvin, or even out at Edwards Air Force Base in the desert. All these spots next Saturday, December 14th, will be part of an incredible program called Wreaths Across America. It started more than 20 years ago at Arlington National Cemetery, and with the strong support of our great American truck drivers, I know a lot of you truckers are out there listening today, this Wreaths Across America has done just that. It has spread all over the nation. Holiday wreaths are laid on the graves of deceased veterans. It's a special way to remember those who are no longer with us and remember them for providing us the freedom to gather together with those who do remain. WreathsAcrossAmerica.org is the website. I have it linked on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and you can pull up the list of locations, find the one nearest you. You can also donate to the cause right there. Wreaths Across America, another great effort to remember the price of freedom during this holiday season. And yeah, if you are in Elmer Wright's hometown of Clovis, get out there to the cemetery in Clovis next Saturday morning around 8 o'clock. When we come back, we'll go back to Tarawa with Elmer Wright, who will also take us to Tinian and explain the situation there that almost took his life. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.